Mutual presents Alan Scott in his daily feature story column, Once Over Lightly, heard Monday through Friday at the same time.
Hello, this is Alan Scott saying things about this and that. Well, I have now heard of everything. Until today, I was a little boy, callow and bucolic, to whom the facts of life were a closed book. Now, my eyes are open. I have heard of everything. I knew that the government, in its gymnastic eagerness to unload a lot of wartime leftovers, had committed some pretty goofy hijinks. I knew that bridges had been offered for sale, and LSTs, and tanks, and factories. I read about the sanitaria for white mice offered on the bargain counter. And in glancing at Fred Ottman's column, I even knew about the 2-year-old flabby and tired girdles that suddenly came to light from the unused store of whack unmentionables, and that they, too, were half-heartedly put up for bids. No takers, though, because even though they were made of pre-war elastic, those girdles, they were so staled by long storage that they wouldn't do for girdling anything but some limp gelatin dessert. What it was that graduated me into the Valhalla of the blasé was learning that the Navy had sold a hole in the ground. This, I think, is the last word, the ultimate in mercantile phenomena. To think that the Navy, my own flesh and malaria shots Navy, would come to this. They have actually sold for money, in a legalized transaction, a by-gum hole in the ground. I always thought that was just a gag, didn't you? You know, people say, what do you get for your money? You don't even get a hole in the ground. I used to associate that phrase with Florida real estate sharpies whose idea of an afternoon's fun was to sell some chump an attractive lot under a swamp. But this really happened, and here's how. The Navy sold some property at a former airplane plant at Taftville, that's near Norwich, Connecticut. Then it was discovered that on the ground there was a hole, green grass growing all around, no doubt, and by the beard of the Judge Advocate General, they had neglected to sell the hole. It was important, too, because the hole had been listed as an asset. It was an asset because it had to be dug and lined at considerable expense and had been used in the construction of airplane propellers. This shocking discovery shook the Pentagon building from the gun clear up to the penthouse and caused a severe throbbing in the accounting department. Gold braid shuddered like sunlight reflected on a lake. The conscience of a government agency is a strange and unfathomable thing. Out in the Pacific areas, it's the thing to dump jeeps and Amtraks into the sea to get rid of them. Lots of them. No day is complete without its splash in the blue Pacific, closing over thousands of dollars worth of good gear. But a hole in the ground, 10 by 8 by 6 feet, is an asset and could not be disposed of without at least some token of payment. So the Navy duly addressed a formal communication to the Maxim Corporation, asking them please to come across with something, maybe just a buck, to make it legal. But pay up for the hole in the ground. The Maxim Corporation, having their own bookkeeping headaches, at first resented the anticlimactic billing. They were going to tell the Navy, look, fellas, if you don't think we're entitled to this hole in the ground, why don't you come and cart it away? We'll provide the truck. But carting away a hole in the ground is a trick which even the Navy hasn't perfected. So, in the interest of facilitating the reconversion program, the dollar was duly paid, and the Navy filed the following receipt. Quote, this is to advise the addressee that for the price of $1, you have bought the cement hole 10 feet long, 8 feet wide, and 6 feet deep, resting in the southwest corner of the main building near the plant. This office has received the prescribed amount, and the title is now in possession of the addressee, unquote. Thus was consummated the strangest sale of the 20th century. I wonder if you've been talking about that Blue Mound, Illinois incident around your house, as we have around ours. You know what I mean, that thing written up in last night's edition of the papers. It's no great shakes, probably won't resolve the course of the infinite tomorrow. But in its own vest pocket measure, it's an interesting issue. I'm referring to the case of the two high school girls out there in Blue Mound, Illinois, Dolly and Teresa True, whose prospects of graduation are being stymied by their father's refusal to let them wear shorts to gym class as the other youngsters do. Of course, it's none of my business. I can't stop the father from deciding how his daughter shall dress, but neither can he stop me from thinking about it and speculating on whether or not he's doing a wise thing. The accounts were kind of skimpy, but I gather the situation was something like this. The high school has certain fixed requirements in the way of physical education program. The uniform for taking part in the program includes shorts for the girls. Mr. True objects on the grounds of what he loosely refers to as decency. My girls don't wear shorts at home, he said, and they don't want to do it in public. The principal of the high school wrote to Mr. True, pointing out
that the state law required the pupils to take the physical ed course or they don't graduate. Seems to me that legally the father will win out there. I doubt that public school authorities have the legal right to prescribe any uniform of apparel to the point where not conforming will stand in the way of graduation.
That sounds too much like a Nazi youth movement.
Legally, the father may be on firm ground, but I wonder if morally he's on the up and up. I don't know any of those high school kids out there in Blue Mound, but I'd be willing to bet that not one of them ever thought there was anything indecent about wearing gym shorts until Mr. True got hoity-toity about it. I suppose there's something to be said for sticking by your guns and standing apart from the crowd and expressing your individuality. But the something that is to be said is not always, and not necessarily, a good something. It depends, I should think, on whether your expression of individuality is inspired of intelligence. Usually, it appears that the best course with children is to let them conform. Oh, I don't mean if a gang decided to burn up a freight car or anything like that. Kids can get wild ideas that are hazardous and destructive and are not to be encouraged. But a harmless thing like wearing shorts for gym class, prescribed by school and all, what does it accomplish to object to that, except to raise ugly and graceless issues where there were none before? When I was in grade school, the little girls used to wear big, black, billowy bloomers and white midi blouses. Remember those? Shorts are much more sensible for athletics than those clumsy get-ups. But even bloomers, when the whole class was so dressed, there was certainly nothing indecent about it. Sometimes in a class like this, your first quick sympathy goes out to the parents. Somehow you feel the parents are bound to be right. Papa knows best, sort of thing. But why does Papa necessarily know best? Not all papas are bright papas. A high intelligence quotient is not prerequisite to parenthood. If a man is not particularly bright, becoming a father doesn't make him any brighter. He can be wrong. And if his error is going to single out his children and make them unwholesomely conspicuous, he's being not only stubborn, but stupid. The old expression, "it's a wise father who knows his own child," means something more than establishing paternity. It implies that there's so much change in the idiom of manners and customs between generations that parents can't quite keep up. Usually, it's good doctrine to let them conform to their contemporaries, especially where the school sets the pace. Schools can be wrong, too, but you do a child immeasurable hurt by keeping them out of step. When my little sister was at school, it was in the very best taste, apparently, and I guess it still is on the campus, to wear soiled brown and white saddle shoes. When Mitzi got a new pair of shoes, she'd spend the weekend out in the yard getting them scuffed up. If she appeared at the drugstore with gleaming white shoes, she would have been a nick, or a cookie pusher, or whatever the current term was for not being hep. Things like that distort a child's personality. When we talked about this at the house last night, we decided that Papa True out there in Blue Mound, being the solicitous father he is, must certainly want his daughters to know how to swim. You can never tell when that ability will mean their lives. And he probably sends them into the swimming pool or to the lake wearing four petticoats, an ankle-length street dress, a bonnet, a shawl, and hip boots. Certainly not a bathing suit. Not decent. I see where they've been selling old retired streetcars in Chicago to be used as dwellings. Business is brisk, too. They sold about 250 in the first few hours of trade yesterday. Not a bad buy. $300 for a 64-passenger job. Nice, cozy little place. And really not so ridiculous as it may at first appear. After all, in a city as big as Chicago, where many a wage earner spends an hour and 35 minutes on a streetcar each way 6 days a week, he might as well be living in one. No kitchen privileges, of course, but two-way ventilation, and lots of it. I wonder how far this thing will go. I read, too, in last night's paper about a young couple who bought a barrel that used to be a hot dog stand somewhere, and they're using it for a home. Next thing you know, you'll see ads like this. For sale or rent, one bureau drawer, deep, commodious, lined with last Wednesday's Tribune. Camphor treated, can be partitioned for family of four. Or this. Cattle car, nicely scented, now occupied by two friendly cows, willing to share. Apply in person at 5 a.m. Just pull the bell. But look who's kidding about this. Come the 2nd of May, I'll be the guy applying for that bureau drawer and probably finding that it's already taken. Harm of music department. I suppose I should have said charm, because that's what music is supposed to have. But it depends on many things. A, the time of day or night at which the music is being performed. B, by whom, and C, who's listening. Reported in this morning's Times is the saga enacted in the courtroom of Magistrate J. Rowland Sala yesterday. In its origin, it was the not unfamiliar story of somebody playing the piano loud and with indifferent skill at a late party, and a neighbor, not one of the country's leading music appreciators, reporting it to the police. But this had a different twist. The prisoner in the docket was not the piano player, but the bloke who had made the complaint. He was Timothy Collins, a man who stands for no nonsense. And when, several nights ago, he heard the piano forte sounds from the home of his neighbor, William McMahon, at the hour, which was not early, and Mr. Collins' three children were supposed to be asleep, Mr. Collins took steps. He called the neighbor. This got him nothing but an inflamed ear resulting from a scorching telephone conversation, so he called the police. This got him less than nothing, because when the police arrived on the scene, they discovered that the player of the piano was Mrs. Walter Harkins, and as anyone in that Brooklyn borough knows, Mr. Walter Harkins is captain of the borough police. When reporting nocturnal piano disturbances, it is a good idea to keep in mind that it's not good form to report the wife of the local police captain. Nothing could be gaucher. The upshot was that Mr. McMahon, who was hosting the party, filed a charge of disorderly conduct against Timothy Collins for having opened his big fat yap. To this point, the story is sufficiently involved to qualify for the Department of Minor League Confusion, but that's not all. Inasmuch as everybody wants to get into the act, and magistrates and police captains like to scratch each other's back, Magistrate Sala didn't like to pass up the opportunity to make an issue out of an issue. An old Shakespearean actor and a man of pronounced and conspicuous culture, Magistrate Sala asked Mrs. Harkins what kind of music she had been playing, to which she replied modestly that it was just soft ballads. The magistrate was disappointed. He said he'd been sort of hoping that it might have been something like Brahms' Fourth Piano Concerto. Did you ever notice how amateur music lovers delight to roll things like that off their tongue? Brahms' Fourth Piano Concerto. Sounds big league. The magistrate stepped on his tongue this time, though. The Times reporter climbed into a parenthesis in his account this morning to remark that Mrs. Harkins could not very well have played anything like Brahms' Fourth because that eminent composer didn't live long enough to write more than two concerti, numbered from left to right, one and two. There never was a fourth. Magistrate Sala, though, is not a man to be fussed by details. He went right on to compose an opus of his own, to wit, a brand new law, worded this way. Any person who summons the police to his neighbor's house because there is a pianist in the neighbor's home is guilty of disorderly conduct. He didn't think it necessary to add, especially when the piano player is the wife of a friendly police captain. So you see, it depends on A, what time, B, who's doing it, and C, who's listening. You remember the story of the little 9-year-old boy who went from door to door in his block asking his neighbors to sign a petition to quell a local nuisance? On being asked to define what the local nuisance was, he admitted that it was his own piano playing. Incredible things happen, Department. Here's a brace of quickies snatched off a newswire to prove that the incredible does happen. In Culver City, California, where all those movie studios are, a fire broke out, causing damage of several $1,000s. What burned was an asbestos factory. And in Long Beach, California, a woman named Nadine Ramsey came home with a P-38 fighter plane. She had bought it from the War Assets Corporation. The plane was worth $165,000, and Mrs. Ramsey bought it for $1,250. Maybe she didn't exactly need a P-38, but being a woman, how could she resist a bargain like that? Mrs. Mary Berkowitz of Chicago is doing her own housework because her maid has left her. The maid also remembered to take with her, when she left, one $4,000 mink coat, a $1,000 ring, and about $5,000 worth of assorted clothing and jewelry. Mr. Berkowitz was a little wistful about it. You know how it is, losing a maid these days. His comment was, "Too bad she was so likable and efficient." "Efficient," said Mrs. B. "I should say she was. She didn't miss a thing." Ken, was I sort of dragging stuff out today?
Oh, not particularly, Alan.
Well, I admit it. I ran short of material. We had company last night. I just couldn't get anything done.
Well, what's the story on the company?
Oh, it's too long to tell. Now, I can tell it another time. My wife's sister and her mother and a girlfriend of her sister, their two army nurses, came along. I just wanted to know if it was conspicuous because I was trying to make it straight. I was short of material.
No, it's fine.
Didn't you?
We'll get the story tomorrow.
I can sign off now, though.
Sure, go
That'll
ahead.
Be all from Alan Scott.
You have just heard Alan Scott in his daily feature story column, Once Over Lightly. Mr. Scott is heard at this same time over many of these same stations, Monday through Friday. This is the Mutual Broadcasting System.